here. Thank you very much for showing up, and I hope that this mostly will be a discussion session. I'm trying to ask some of the questions that I've been dying to ask. I'll be moderating some panel discussion up here, but we'll quickly move to your questions. So as everyone gives their opening remarks, which we, will be very brief, I want you to think of, what the question you've been wanting to ask or on the subject of energy and the environment and where we're going, what's important and what are we missing, and so that's, this is going to be a, truly a discussion session. I hope everybody can bring, get something to come away with the session with some things that they hadn't known about before. I first would like to introduce our panelists, Lou Moore. We were talking beforehand. Lou is the chief of the Energy and Pollution Prevention Bureau for the state of Montana, Department of Environmental Quality. And she got her start by reading Silent Spring from Rachel Carson, a book that I love. And this was back in 1978. She took this career path and has stuck with it ever since. And Jeffrey Greenblatt here, he's from the project scientist from the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. He, too, was inspired by some literature. This was Scientific American, and it was a 1989 special issue about the kinds of problems, problem that is need, that needs to be done by scientists. And so he chose field of energy. And this is Patrick Hogan. And Patrick is with the Pew Center on Climate Change and Global Climate Change. And he's also based in D.C. Right? And so his he read the book Ishmael by, I don't remember the author.
Daniel Quarn.
And again, it was, sometimes you need that spark to get into this field. I think we all can identify with that. Like I said, this panel is going to be about robust discussion, but I would like each of the panelists to give you a little bit about their background as well as their area of expertise. So we'll start with Lou.
Thank you, Lisa, and welcome to Montana. I hope you're having a chance to get outside and enjoy our beautiful state. And we've been working really hard to get you some good weather this last time, which is actually not untypical for Montana in October. Lisa introduced me as the Bureau Chief for Energy and Pollution Prevention with the state of Montana, which is true, but I also serve in the role as the State Energy Director. Every state has an energy office associated with it, and most of us are quite well buried within state government somewhere. But we do have state energy offices. It's a wonderful source of information or questions that you might have about what's going on locally. And there's a website you can find us at called NASIO.org, National Association of State Energy Officials. So I'll put that out for you, and I'm on the board for NASIO, and we'll be speaking about some of what's happening on the national level and giving you more specific information on the Montana area, because of course that's where I'm located. States have really been the leader in setting energy policy for the nation, and much of that leadership comes from the state energy offices through a state energy program. The state energy programs were started in 1977, and they have been a roller coaster ride with the Department of Energy in terms of the types of efforts and the amounts of funding that come through to the states. But there are some characteristic pieces. The state energy programs include energy policy work, energy efficiency in buildings, energy efficiency in transportation, development of renewable energy resources, and energy education, outreach, and technical assistance. States are leading by example. 56 states, because the District of Columbia and the territories are considered states under these programs. But 32 states are leading by example with their own state infrastructure, their own buildings, through some type of energy retrofit programs. 28 states are involved with energy efficiency building codes and standards. Montana first adopted energy codes in 1993. Most states now have them, although there's still a handful that have yet to adopt building energy codes. 40 states are providing some type of energy audits, and those range widely from commercial buildings to industrial buildings to just looking at government sectors and institutions. institutionals, maybe schools, hospitals, and some more at the residential scale, although in most instances now, a lot of the energy audit programs are being picked up by utility companies through demand side management programs or other programs that they're offering. 31 states have renewable portfolio standards, which have a mandate of a certain percentage of electricity to be generated from a renewable energy resource. In Montana, that is primarily wind right now. We are a good wind state, have a lot of that resource, and actually the fastest renewable energy anywhere in the nation right now is coming from wind because it's a quick build if there's a transmission available for it. There are 32 states that provide revolving loan programs of some kind. There's 56 different revolving loan programs out there. Montana has two. We have one for our state buildings where we invest in that infrastructure. We collect the energy savings from utility bills and put them back into the next round of buildings. It's a fairly common model among states. We also provide a revolving loan program for renewable energy retrofits on homes and small businesses. Many states also started energy tax credits well before federal tax credits were available. Much of that has been for the development of renewable energy resources in states, but also to encourage consumers to use energy efficiently in their homes and in their businesses. So that's a kind of a quick overview, and I'll turn it on to our next panelist.
Scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, and I've been in the climate change and energy field for 10 years now. I've held a variety of posts, which has given me exposure to a number of different technology strategies and issues that I can now draw upon to do fairly high-level work looking out multiple decades, and that's what I'm hoping to share with you all today. Just briefly, my bio might, you know, be useful to just summarize the areas that I'm familiar with. I got my start in the energy and climate field at Princeton University as a postdoctoral fellow. There, studying the global climate cycle or carbon cycle, and then I had the opportunity to work on the Wedges papers that Bacall and Sokolow published, which, you know, obviously had a big impact on the community. For me, it taught some interesting lessons, and those can really be summarized as the need to use multiple strategies in order to bring down the emissions level, both globally and, you know, at smaller scale, state and national. But the other interesting thing about that study is it was essentially showing how to keep emissions constant instead of allowing them to double by 2050. And the scientific community is now starting to realize that we really have to bring emissions down much further than that in order to get the stringent climate goals between 350 and 450 parts per million that are being discussed. And that's a much heavier lift. So it sort of resets the expectation from those Wedge studies. But the overall conclusion is still the same, that you need to use a lot of strategies simultaneously. From there, I went to Environmental Defense Fund for a couple of years, where I researched a number of issues that were of concern to the organization. And then I spent some time at Google.org, where my role was renewable energy investments and grants. And I also authored a study called Clean Energy 2030, which was an attempt to provide a roadmap for the United States, significantly reducing carbon emissions, although it wasn't economy-wide, it was only in a couple of sectors. And that kind of brings me to where I am today, where I have been working on two projects, appliance efficiency standards, which kind of moves product by product to squeeze the maximum energy savings out of it at a cost-effective level. And the Department of Energy has been working on this for 20 years now. and is likely to be accelerating their efforts. The other work, though, which I'll largely draw on today, is a study focusing on California's energy future through 2050, and the express goal there is an 80% reduction below 1990 levels economy-wide. And so from the preliminary findings of that study, I'm essentially going to mention five themes or wedges, if you'd like, of the strategy, and those would be significant increases in energy efficiency, both at the device level and buildings, as well as in the transportation sector. Essentially, there's no part of the economy that doesn't have the potential for significant improvements, and it's really going to take a great deal of effort in order to get us there, but it's really essential, because without great increases in efficiency, it just makes the generation of clean electricity and fuels that much more challenging. So that would sort of be the first tier, push efficiency as much as you can. The second one is electrifying our use of energy as much as possible. So this goes beyond moving to plug-in cars. This is also the use of electricity for our building heating and water heating as well. About 95% of U.S. Buildings are heated by natural gas, and we think that that can largely or entirely go away with cost-effective technology. So that's an interesting conclusion, which I'm happy to talk more about. Part of the reason why this needs to happen in as many areas of the economy as possible, and again, this is drawing from California, but it's really applicable nationally and internationally, is because there are many more ways to decarbonize the electricity sector than the direct use of fuels, which I'll touch on in a moment. What I see in my portfolio of nearly zero energy, zero carbon electricity are a portfolio of renewables, which could provide all of the electricity that we need, nuclear power, and the continued use of fossil combustion, but with carbon capture and sequestration. And within all of these, you know, there are combinations that may work in different areas. A lot of it depends on certain technical progress, such as the widespread use of carbon sequestration technology. But really, the common theme we've learned from that, no matter which platform you sort of focus on as your main supplier, there are going to be grid issues that have not been there before. And the reason is, you know, we have loads that fluctuate every hour, every minute actually, and they go up and down every day, and there's seasonal variation. And up till recently, the focus has been on ramping up supply in order to meet that fluctuating load. We now are moving to a system where either you're going to have unpredictable supply because it's largely renewable and not controllable, wind and solar being the prime examples, or the other two technologies I mentioned would have to run essentially flat out or base load in order to get the maximum economic value out of it. And that also presents the same problem, that you can't really control that without large economic impact. So the other sort of hot area is, how are we going to meet the variations in supply with demand? And so that brings up the question of flexible load management, smart grid, you heard the buzzword, smart appliances, et cetera, as well as electricity storage, and possibly some other novel uses, the repurposing of the hydro facilities for load following, or perhaps carbon capture of natural gas turbines so that they can continue to provide services without their carbon emissions. Finally, I wanted to mention the role of biofuels. Very critical, and the reason why is we need to lower the carbon emissions of the parts of the economy we can't electrify, and that the leftover is still significant. Think airplanes, think heavy-duty trucks as the prime examples, and a certain fraction of passenger vehicles that are not going to want to electrify. We think that biomass resources are going to be limited, both at the state level and nationally. And they are not necessarily as low carbon as some proponents would like to make them out to be. And so that problem needs to be solved by technology and policy. But there still may be a limitation, so that presents a grand challenge. The last thing to mention is the role of behavior change, which we're starting to look at. As usual,
Solutions Project Manager with the Pew Center on Global Climate Change. I still don't know exactly what that title means, but Pew's really good for the titles. It's better than being a Problems Project Manager. For those that don't know, Pew is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, independent climate policy and research organization based in Washington, D.C. I'd just like to echo Lisa and say that being here in Montana is really the perfect antidote to too much time spent in D.C. And Pew works on every aspect of the climate problem. We do science research, economics research. We work on policy at every level, international, federal, and state. And I've been there about 4 years, and I've had a number of different roles. Actually started out working on state and regional policy. We actually had Governor Schweitzer speak at Orchard that I was organized a few years ago. Most recently, I've been working on competitiveness issues related to climate policy, mostly at the international level, but also a little bit at the state and regional level. And that's what I'd really like to talk about today. I'm going to be giving a kind of big picture overview of where the markets for the technologies that Jeff mentioned are likely to go, and then how the U.S. can make itself more of a player in what promised to be the major markets of the 21st century. And I was supposed to have a prop, just this report, which I'll be referencing a lot today, which was supposed to arrive at the hotel, but is stuck in post office purgatory somewhere. But if you would like a copy, just find me afterwards. We have them online. We're happy to mail them to you as well.
What's the title?
It's Clean Energy Markets, Jobs, and Opportunities. And it's available at pewclimate.org. So, as I said, most of the major points I'll be mentioning or explained in more detail in the brief. The major themes I want to touch on are the fact that the market for clean energy technologies, this includes renewables, nuclear power, CCS, biofuels, efficiency technologies and services, the whole range, are already large and rapidly expanding. And well-designed domestic climate and clean energy policy here in the U.S. can better position domestic firms to compete in these emerging international markets. And in fact, the more these markets grow internationally, the more opportunities there will be for businesses all over the world. And the best way to maximize the size of these markets is for the U.S. to take a leadership position in helping to forge a robust international agreement on climate change that really fosters innovation in low-carbon technology around the world. So as I mentioned, the numbers speak for themselves. In the last about 5 years, between 2004 and 2009, on average, the market for clean energy technologies grew at a compound annual growth rate of almost 40%. It's about 39%, which is I don't think is a claim that can be made of a lot of other markets out there. These markets reached an investment total of $173 billion in 2008. That dipped a little bit in 2009 due to the economic recession, but they've actually been rebounding fairly quickly, especially relative to a lot of other markets around the world. And it's also pretty clear, given the actions being taken by other countries, that these markets are not going away anytime soon. These are going to be large opportunities over the next century. Even under a business as usual case, in which countries pretty much just keep doing what they're doing, the International Energy Agency predicts that the market for clean energy generation technologies, so renewables, nuclear, and CCS, will be close to $1.6 trillion cumulatively between now and 2020. And of course, that number is significantly larger, assuming aggressive levels of action by the major emitters around the world. So, these these opportunities are real, but there is evidence that the U.S. is ceding ground and missing out on its ability to compete in these markets. In fact, 90% of the market for clean energy technologies is already outside of the United States, primarily Asia and Europe. And if you look at the investment totals around the world, the EU is well ahead of us. China is significantly ahead of us. And they're both growing much more rapidly. In fact, in some years over the last few, the U.S. has had a negative growth trend in investment in clean energy technologies. And the these moves on the part of other nations are not accidental. They all have strong, serious climate and energy policies, including China, which they're adopting for a number of reasons. Obviously, climate change is a big driver, but a lot of countries are concerned about energy independence, energy price volatility, resource constraints, and other environmental problems like regional air pollution. Some examples of the policies other countries are adopting. China has a massive $400 billion clean tech investment program scheduled over the next 10 years. EU and Germany also have some of the more aggressive policies out there. So, you know, one question that you might ask is why? You know, why does it matter if we act now? Why can't we just wait to join the party 10 years down the road? And as other industries have historically demonstrated, Silicon Valley, aircraft manufacturing in Seattle, automobiles in Detroit, it really matters where industries first get established. And this is because if you create domestic demand that can help foster lead markets, that can attain a sort of self-reinforcing cycle of growth and innovation that can make a given region a major center of activity in a particular industry. So lastly, I just want to say that there are a number of policies that we can adopt to help foster these kinds of markets and spur this kind of growth, including, obviously, a comprehensive economy-wide climate policy that puts a price on carbon, but also more targeted R&D policies, tax credits and incentives, and a range of other policies as well.
Actually, it's good to know another question I had. I'm probably going to ask each of you a few different questions, but what you were talking a little bit about in your last few comments brings to mind, obviously, the Chinese investment in renewable energy like solar. And is this a good thing because it's cheap and it might help drive adoption, or is it a bad thing? It might stifle innovation. And maybe either of you could take a crack at that.
I'll just quickly say that you know, there's a lot of rhetoric that gets tossed around about the competitiveness issue. And it's not exactly that China's necessarily taking something away from us. Countries don't really compete the same way that companies do within a given market. You know, like Coke and Pepsi are, you know, they're fighting for finite shares of a given market size. When it comes to international trade, countries provide markets for one another's products. And you can actually grow the size of the global economic pie over time, which means that there are bigger opportunities for everybody. It's more that, you know, we're missing the boat. We're letting these new opportunities slip away, and China isn't. So China will have the manufacturing capacity and increasingly the innovation capacity to play in these new markets. China itself will be a big new market, whereas U.S. firms are increasingly losing ground.
Jeff, can you talk about the innovation capacity?
Well, let's see. I mean, I guess I have a couple of perspectives on that. I mean, one is, you know, everybody realizes that renewable technology is almost always more expensive than their fossil, you know, equivalents, and so any market development that lowers those costs are going to have a benefit for you know, achieving renewable energy goals, for consumers to make the choice, for company investments, etc. So from that perspective, it's companies who have renewable technology in the U.S. may be outsourcing their manufacturing, but the knowledge base is still firmly held, you know, domestically. So I don't know. I mean, that's the way so many companies do business these days. So I'm not sure that it's really seeding ground unless you're talking about, you know, complete vertically integrated industries outside that are also that are already bigger than what's here. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely still true that the U.S. Has a lot of the innovative edge in developing new technologies. Now, when it comes to jobs and where the manufacturing is actually taking place, I think it's important to keep in mind that with a lot of these technologies and services, and manufacturing is just one piece of the puzzle. And a lot of these technologies, you know, wind turbines, nuclear reactors, solar panels, have really extensive value chains. And you know, certainly, there are probably going to be components manufactured in China, maybe assembled in Europe, and eventually like installed over here. But if you're creating domestic demand, a lot of these technologies have jobs that cannot be outsourced. And that's especially true for things like building efficiency retrofits. You know, you can't send a building to China and have it modified and sent back.
I need to follow that up with Lou, who's home efficiency was where she really got her start. She knows quite a bit about that. Because, you know, you have been the steward of a lot of the Recovery Act money, and you have a big challenge there. Can you give us some real-world examples of what that has been like? And we talked a little bit about how in the last 3 years you've done something like the work of the last 18 years, or in the next 3 years. I can't remember what you said, but yeah.
Sure. The Recovery Act money has been a real, I think, benefit to the states and to the work that's going on. And of the $80 billion of kind of the clean energy economy money, $6.3 billion came to the states, to the state energy offices, for work with state governments and local governments. And the one example Lisa gave is our state buildings retrofit program. We're doing 89 projects right now under that program. That's as much work in 3 years as we've done in the past 18 years. And we are putting a lot of that work out to local architects and engineers for design, and then, of course, throughout the state on the construction field. But states have used those monies in a variety of ways, and some of the real, you know, nuts and bolts of it is infrastructure development. But there's also pieces of it going out in lots of ways. Washington State was able to attract an LED manufacturing company to come in from China to the United States and establish. They're looking at, I think, Moses Lake as their location for that facility. In Montana, we were able to take funds, and we're funding three kind of innovative areas. One is growing algae using the carbon dioxide from a lumber facility up in Columbia Falls, gaining the off-gassing of methane from that to create power and putting it back into the lumber facility. So that's scheduled to break ground in the next couple of months.
What's the name of that?
AACT, and I can tell you the name of that company. Algae Aquaculture Technology. Obviously, it's not one that's easily in my brain yet. Another work that we're doing is in Ronan, Montana. If you drove Glacier, you went through Ronan. It's a tiny little community as you start into the Indian Reservation. It is a conductor-optimized rotary energy product, and it's just a different type of a motor generator technology for wind development. We expect that it's going to be a less expensive technology. And then another area that we're looking at is that we have a lot of dry land in Montana that's not been used to farm for food, but there's crop opportunities there. We're growing camelina up in the northern part of the state, which is an oil seed crop. We're producing biodiesel from that right now. We're using it in various bus fleets around the state, but the renewable energy, or the Recovery Act monies is being used to partner with the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, and we're doing biodiesel demonstration in their engines in Havre, Montana, where there's a technology school looking at the mechanics. We're able to do studies on those runs of that engines on a monthly basis. So, again, you know, a lot of innovation coming out at the state level, and just a couple of examples of what we can do.
I'd like to follow up. With Jeffrey and that. Can you, I guess, talk about the roles of biofuels? And you were talking about how it's a multi-step process, you know, and in terms and looking out into the future. Can you tell us a little bit about how that fits?
Sure. Okay. the framework to think about is this. So again, our study looked out to 2050, essentially to an end game state. Really, I mean, we sort of said how far out do we need to go to essentially zero emissions? I mean, we're talking very significant reductions from where we are today, on the order of 90% below business as usual. And then it's actually a race to how quickly can we get there. But you know, the point is we get there and we stay there. So assuming that growth maybe tapers off a little, the first thing we do is try to reduce our demand for liquid and gaseous fuels in some of the ways I touched on, trying to electrify both transportation and building heat and industrial process heat. Again, there will be economics that sometimes force a company not to go electrical. We don't have all the data to really determine where those crossover points are, but what we have concluded is there's still a significant amount of demand, both in California and presumably elsewhere, for liquid fuels. The biomass availability, and I'm talking, you know, agricultural waste, forest waste, municipal solid waste, dedicated bioenergy crops that are grown on land that wouldn't be used to produce food. You add that all up, you assume increases in efficiency, you assume, advanced biofuel technology to convert those cellulosic feedstocks into essentially designer fuels that can substitute for gasoline and diesel today, so we're not just talking ethanol. And you still come up short with the expected demand. So the role of biomass is it's going to be a pretty valuable commodity in a world where you're not allowed to burn fossil energy. And obviously that's the biggest constraint, is you need to say no to that in some policy fashion so that you greatly reduce your emissions. The other problem with biofuels is that they're not necessarily zero carbon. It will be better than they are today, which is in some cases for corn ethanol, very marginal reductions. But it's not at all settled that we're going to be at a net zero. I hope that we can get there. Some interesting discussions in the last panel in this room on what needs to happen in order to make biofuels actually zero net carbon fuels. But I can go on, but maybe that's enough.
Well, I think that I'd like to ask Patrick to talk about how, I know when I read the report that you had said there's a real race to move towards developing these markets for clean energy economy and sort of to support domestic demand for this. What are the policy implications of that? What do we need, and what are you arguing for? And what are some of the what trouble lies ahead?
I think the key policy, it's been discussed a lot over the last several years, is a comprehensive climate and energy policy that caps emissions and somehow puts a price on greenhouse gases. That's that price signal is going to be the cornerstone of fostering these new markets, creating demand that will attract new industries and new technologies, and focus for innovation. In addition to that, there's definitely a large role for research and development within the government and partnerships between the government and business. I think state policy also will continue to play a key role, especially now that the prospects for anything significant happening at the federal level are fairly dim for the foreseeable future. But the states know, there are over 30 states now with renewable energy standards. Lou mentioned some of the other efficiency policies that a lot of states are adopting. And I think those as well are going to help drive these markets forward.
I realize I'm a little letting this discussion go a little bit longer than I had earlier expected, but I am going to be opening up right now for questions. So please come up here. I'm going to use the mic and we'll move it back.
Can't we just do it from here?
Yeah, we could, and we'll just repeat the questions. That's okay. But I just want to make sure I get everybody in order and everybody gets their chance. So go ahead.
Yeah.
And identify yourself, please,
sure.
And your affiliation.
Yeah, John Addison published a Clean Fleet report. Great framing of the issues and information. You mentioned renewable energy, energy storage. I was hoping you could elaborate on where we may be going with flow batteries, compressed air, even vehicle-to-grid, if you could kind of expand on energy storage.
Okay, so the question is about energy storage, and you wanted specifically to know where things may be headed with flow batteries, compressed air storage, vehicle to grid, et cetera.
Et cetera.
Yes. Okay. Well, so I, and this is maybe speaking more personally than whatever my organization officially believes, because the jury is still out on this, you know, I believe that there is going to be an important role for electricity storage moving forward, simply because when you look at the challenge to a grid, which, as I said earlier, is going to have a supply that is not nearly as flexible as it is today, it's not going to be all solved with one problem, with one solution. So I think that we will see a significant increase in the amount of flexible load management, both utilities controlling the loads remotely, as well as owners making their own decisions, and you know, with computer aid probably, about when to draw on the power grid, or possibly doing on-site generation when the power is too expensive otherwise. So I do think that we're going to see a significant flattening of the daily load curve, as it were, you know, from peak to off-peak times. But that's not going to be completely flat. And so there is going to be a role for electricity storage if the economics support it. It's a little too soon to tell. I mean, we're still kind of at the nascent stage. You know, the reason we don't see a lot of these technologies on the market is because they are still very expensive.
Yeah, how do you forecast learning curves?
You know, people do it. People forecast learning curves. There's uncertainty in that art. Maybe I can't prognosticate as much as you'd like me to, particularly. I do know that there are some compressed air storage projects, which has long been talked about as a very cost-effective technology for bulk storage, maybe not as fast as some of the others you're talking about, flow batteries, flywheels. And there are some projects that have been announced that look like they may be moving forward in California and elsewhere. So I think that it's an interesting story to follow. I would like to see more coverage of this type of technology and sort of where various utilities see the role for it. I think there's a number of horses that need to be bet on simultaneously, though, because it may be that it's still more cost effective to burn natural gas and sequester its carbon and use that for load following. The economics will determine it, but like we said a few minutes ago, there has to be a carbon policy to force those choices toward a different point than they are at now.
We're actually going to be doing the microphone thing. I got a note. I got to use the microphone, so I have to be good. And so please state your affiliation.
Hi, I'm Tom with the Casper Star Tribune, and we get a lot of wind in our state, but one of the things that comes up a lot is wind energy is subsidized, and so I was wondering what those subsidies are, and I guess maybe break it down by cents per megawatt or however that's done. And in this political climate, yeah, right. Yeah, I just wanted to cut me off. In this political climate, deficits and all that stuff, and in a state like ours, really punches out a lot of fossil fuels. you know, there could be some resistance to why should we subsidize some that, you know, we're competing with. And so I know what everybody is subsidized, but I was just wondering if you could break it down by coal, gas, nuclear, wind, solar, that kind of thing, if you happen to know that.
And who's this question directed towards, or any
to probably anybody who can answer it.
I know that would answer, but
I can take a stab. So wind currently receives a federal tax credit of about, so it's cents per kilowatt hours, I mean megawatt hours we used to, but cents per kilowatt hour. The average retail rate across the country is about 10 cents per kilowatt hour for all electricity. That includes the overheads for transmission and distribution. It varies from region to region. It can be as high as 30 cents or more in places like Hawaii, and cheap as like maybe 5 cents in some parts of the country. But anyway, to frame it, wind currently enjoys around a 2 cent per kilowatt hour subsidy called the production tax credit. And as far as subsidies for sort of coal or natural gas, I'm actually not familiar with that.
You know, I don't have actual numbers for you. I think it's a very excellent question to look at. From the state perspective, we provide production tax credits, or in Montana, a clean and green development tax credit. That credit is applicable to certain types of transmission lines and carbon dioxide pipelines when they would become available in addition to wind. So there's a lot out there, but I would say that there have been subsidies to get the coal and to get natural gas and to get oil, you know, developed as well, but I don't have a comparison for you.
I guess I would just add more broadly, I think there is certainly a role for subsidies. When you're talking about wind and other low carbon sources, there are additional social benefits that accrue when you bring these into the energy mix. I think that's something that's worth supporting. The price of wind over the last 10-20 years has come down dramatically and is likely to continue falling. And in fact, in many parts, parts of the country, it's close to grid parity. So I think eventually these are policies that can be phased out, but there's a continuing role for them in the near term.
Gloria Gonzalez from Environmental Finance Magazine. Patrick and Jeffrey, I was wondering if you could follow up on that. In terms of a carbon price, would that be more beneficial for renewable energy development, or would it be more of a benefit for nuclear development at this point, factoring in all the current cost implications and the subsidies that are involved in those technologies? And Lou, I was wondering if you could comment on the role of Montana in terms of regional carbon trading now that the focus is shifting away from a federal carbon program to some of these regional trading programs.
We'll go first.
Sure. The largest regional cap and trade program, or the one that's furthest ahead, is REGGI in the Northeast. In the western part of the United States, the Western Climate Initiative is looking at a cap and trade program. Really, I think, had put a lot of hope in a national program coming on board. There is still involvement in the WCI with all of the, or most of the Canadian provinces, and many of the western states. Montana is part of that. We are not at this point thinking that's something that's going to happen anytime soon, but it's also something that we haven't given up on.
Any other questions?
Yeah, the other part of the question was about whether a carbon price on electricity, or just generally a carbon price, would benefit renewables or nuclear better or more. Now, that's interesting. I've never thought of that question. So I guess my answer would be, there is no single price for any of these technologies. So, you know, I sort of have to think in terms of ballparks. I would say that it would benefit both of them roughly a similar amount. I think for renewable development, issues that often Trump, besides Chrysler, also how close they are to existing load centers or to existing transmission corridors. So there's the problem of not having adequate transmission capacity that can thwart an otherwise promising project and add to costs if that has to be bankrolled by the wind developer. You know, for nuclear, I'm a little puzzled as to why hasn't it grown for the last couple of decades, and I have to think the cost has a lot to do with that, but there is also, you have to acknowledge that there is significant citizen discomfort with expansion of nuclear power, and that's not going to be solved by a carbon price either, so I think perhaps the battle lines are elsewhere than just the cost, but it would definitely bring more carbon, low-carbon electricity into the mainstream by having a price on carbon.
I just echo what Jeff said and say that the issues facing nuclear are not going to be solved by a carbon price alone. When you have a plant up and running, it's actually fairly cheap to generate electricity using nuclear power. Problem lies in the upfront costs of building the facility, regulatory hurdles, resistance from population centers nearby. So in order to overcome those kinds of hurdles, you need additional policies like loan guarantees, permitting reform. So a carbon price alone is not going to overcome those.
Jeffrey, you said in your opening remarks that one of the goals you were sort of establishing was to electrify power as much as possible, which is not something we hear very often, particularly when it comes to building heat. So I wondered if you could elaborate on that.
Sure, happy to.
What would the source of the electricity be? That's the other thing.
Oh, yes, yes.
The fuel source of the electricity.
So remember, we have a very long-term perspective. So the assumption going in, and that I mentioned later in terms of the available types of generation for low-carbon electricity, we think are plentiful enough in order to give an electricity system that emits almost no carbon. So that's what makes it more advantageous than burning fossil fuel, because you're basically consuming a carbon-free fuel, electricity, rather than something that intrinsically has carbon in it. Yes, you could produce bio-based, biomethane, for instance. The fuel cycle Y could have very low carbon emissions, but as I mentioned previously, there's a problem with the biomass availability supply, and that kind of precludes it, because you can, for stationary applications, you can wire it, meaning switching to electricity. You can do that with much more difficulty with mobile, with transportation. Okay, and I think people appreciate the problem with range with plug-in hybrid cars or all-electric cars that I think is going to continue to limit its penetration unless there's a real significant breakthrough in battery technology. But still, you have heavy-duty trucks that are moving things hundreds of miles, thousands of miles, across the country that we just don't think can be electrified. So the source of fuel, I think I've answered for you. And then in terms of how you do it, you can use electricity much more efficiently than you can a direct fuel if you're using something like a heat pump. So you can get up to three units of heat out of a heat pump for every unit in. And you can only do as great as 100% efficiency if you're burning a fuel. So that really makes the equation quite attractive.
Lisa Duchesne, I'm a freelance writer out of central Pennsylvania, where I live and work, and wondering if you could comment on development of natural gas with Lobster drilling Marcellus Shale. Can you kind of help me put that in some context? This is wise, this is not wise. Yeah.
wondering, listening to this, that they might have a lot of, there are things they could be doing from a renewable perspective. It depends on our state policy. Do you know what might be available to a town like that that has said no to natural gas drilling? Or if you don't know, where would you look for that kind of, anyone who wants to?
It sort of sounds like a question for me, but maybe I won't grab it first. I'm happy to. Okay. Actually, if you could just clarify part of the first was about
on the development of natural gas, you know, natural gas. Is it a great bridge fuel, or is this really stupid? This is so awesome.
Okay, so is natural gas a good bridge fuel, or is it really stupid to boil it down?
Yeah.
And then the other one was about alternatives to drilling in a community that is largely subsisted on fossil extraction.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I think so the advantage of taking a 2050 perspective is that you kind of know where you need to go. And our opinion, you know, I'm really speaking for a committee of scientists and engineers here, is that natural gas is a good bridge fuel, but it's going to play a limited role in the final solution because it still contains carbon. And when you do the math, you find out how much you have to squeeze out of your energy system, even the amount left for conventional uses of natural gas, which is largely building, heating, industrial, you know, thermal uses, is enough to exceed your quota of carbon emissions. Right? And to that, then you add the petroleum that you have to burn for airplanes and trucks and some other uses. You're in your way over. So, you know, you can't keep using it. It needs to be used sparingly, like an expensive perfume. You know, so I mentioned earlier that it just came into my head. I don't know where that quote's going. as a flavoring. Natural gas, so the other thing is carbon capture and storage. You can't cost effectively capture the carbon emissions from hundreds of millions of you know, distributed burners across the country. But you can do it at the power plant level. And so if carbon capture and sequestration is sufficiently cost effective, you can capture the carbon from the natural gas turbines and continue to use it in a larger way that way. But I just don't see the role for it out in buildings, you know, in 40 years' time. We've got to come up with something that's lower carbon than that.
I'll weigh in and disagree a little bit. I think natural gas is an excellent fuel, certainly as a bridge fuel, and that while we want to see a future that is going to be heavily reliant on renewable energy, we also recognize that there's a lot to happen between now and then, and you know, 2050 is 40 years away, and I can remember what we were doing 40 years back, and we made great leaps of faith, but we have a long ways to go. Natural gas is a very clean-burning fuel. It works very well in the existing infrastructure of our buildings, and just looking at what it takes to change out a boiler in a building, change out a system, thinking that we're going to make that huge switch to electricity quickly, well, I'm not saying quickly, it's going to take a long time to get there. And thank you. I also would ask you to think about. Natural gas is a good fuel. Buildings will need to be changed in terms of their systems to switch from natural gas to electricity. That's certainly very doable, but it's going to take a long time to get us there. Think about where electricity comes from and how it gets anywhere. And it's the transmission grid. The grid has an enormous amount of work to be able to take care of renewables coming online right now. And when I think of the coal that we send out of the state of Montana to Southern California on a transmission line and the amount of loss that comes through that line, I have to wonder, you know, when is that going to be of significant improvement that it's going to be equal to what you get out of a natural gas line where there's just far less loss. So I'm thinking maybe we're 150 years, not 50 years out on that.
Can I respond to you? Okay. First, I wanted to give one number that puts the transmission losses in perspective, because that often comes up. Nationally, electric losses are about 6% grid-wide, which I don't consider a real big concern. I mean, of course, locally on particular grids, it may be higher than that, depending on how long. But longer lines tend to have higher voltage transmission, and that reduces the losses. The other thing I want to counterbalance as far as the long-term perspective for changing out existing infrastructure, that is, I think, maybe the biggest bottleneck. We've got about 1% to 2% new building construction, I guess that's for California, annually, which means that it's going to take a long time to touch all the buildings, at least as far as new construction goes. Remodeling is higher than that, but it's usually fairly cosmetic. But then, on the other hand, the life of a boiler or furnace is typically around 20 years, I think. So I think that you can get there in 40 years with sufficiently strong policy that supports the consumer switch out to that. If it's more cost-effective to buy an electric heat pump central heater than a gas-fired heater, I think we can construct a policy that will allow that transformation to take place over the only a four-year time horizon.
Do you have any more questions? Or any further, any journalists with a question?
Hi, I'm Diane Sines. I'm with Oceana, which is in the National Ocean Conservation Group, which is a big proponent of offshore wind on the Atlantic coastline. And from a policy perspective, do you think the job creation argument is strong enough to make that argument to policymakers on Capitol Hill and in states that we must level the playing field from a subsidies perspective? I know that the solar industry and the wind industry have really struggled to try to persuade policymakers that they need equal treatment.
Who's this for?
Whoever wants to take
it. Policy, maybe Patrick would like to take it?
Sure.
This will be the last question.
I think when you're talking about particular technologies, particular sectors, there is a real case to be made for job creation. You can sort of unfold the supply chain and make the case that there will be jobs created locally, regardless of where particular homes may be manufactured. You need people to install and maintain these technologies. I think more broadly, politically, it's pretty hard to make a winning case in terms of net job creation. Just personally, from the studies I've seen on both sides, you have people arguing that climate policy will destroy millions of jobs. You have people saying that it will create millions of jobs. And I just don't think that anyone's really figured out a good way to make that calculation. And so I tend to ignore those numbers and just focus on sort of more technology-specific or sector-specific perspective.
This is Jeff. I can offer one nugget on the job creation. I agree that it's complicated, and often what you're doing is, yes, you're giving work to one set of people because of this technology, taking it away from what they might have been doing otherwise. But when we put together the Clean Energy 2030 study, we did do our best effort to estimate the job creation from a very largely renewable electricity system and essentially retirement of all the existing coal-fired power plants, and found that there was a significant net benefit job-wise when you include all the indirect effects. And you're welcome to look at our calculations online.
Thank you.
we at the state level have been just besieged with requests for how many jobs are created from this task, this task, this task. And it's an argument that's selling right now that people are listening to. So to make the argument.
I would just quickly add that you know, it also depends on the time horizon you're talking about. I think in the near terms, for 5 to 10 years, it's difficult to estimate net job creation impacts. Going forward, though, I think it's safe to say there will be a transitional period in which jobs are created in some industries, lost in others. But ultimately, you may very well see a net benefit. And in fact, the German government has done some rigorous analysis of their policies, and they've calculated that they will ultimately be net job creators, sort of in the 2020 to 2030 time range.
And so I have a few questions I'd like to ask just to wrap it up, and each of you, I hopefully can address this. In fact, I would ask me each to point out one example. What should journalists know about the about something in the future, about either something we should be covering or not covering well? I mean, what are we missing? You know, this is why we're here. We want to know what we're missing, and we are hoping you can tell us. So, Liz, you want to start?
Think on that one for a minute. That's a good question. And I don't have an immediate response in terms of what's missing. I'd say focus hard on the renewable energy technologies and look at what's happening on the local level that might be able to be expanded. Because I think a lot of the solutions need to be found at the local level and moved around, because I just don't see them happening right now on the national level.
One thing. I mentioned 5 in my opening remarks, of which 4 I would reiterate because I didn't really touch on behavior. But you know, efficiency can be greatly increased, and what seems to be the bottleneck is policy standards. I'm a big believer in standards since having joined a standards team. It needs to happen faster. So I think perhaps one angle might be, what are people thinking about as far as how to accelerate the adoption of aggressive standards on efficiency, not just appliances, but sort of building codes and, you know, throughout the industry and also in the transport sector. Electrification, I think people's interest is something that you might not have heard before. So I think that would be interesting to follow up on other people's opinions on that. The limitation of biofuels, I'll emphasize again, I think that's going to perhaps be more important than any sort of advanced technology for making them. Or at least it will make us dependent on imports from more biomass-rich countries such as Brazil.
I just think it's important to bear in mind when talking about climate energy policy that there are real economic benefits associated with adopting these policies. And I think that's something that gets lost a lot in policy discussions, mainly because we're much better at quantifying the costs associated with a policy than we are at quantifying its benefits, both in terms of environmental benefits and job creation and other economic benefits here at home. So I would just look for the positive aspects of the competitiveness story when it comes to climate and energy policy.
We have time for one last question from the audience. Anyone?
Want to
walk up a little bit and answer?
Sure. One thing that we're interested in is helping landowners to create energy systems locally, specifically wind. And one thing that I wanted to get the panel's perspective on is the need for policy that maximizes wealth creation locally, so that you don't have loss of wealth that goes out of state or overseas to companies like Iberdrola or other big wind development corporations.
Right. The question was the need for policy to... Can you repeat that?
Sure. the need for policy to create
local wealth creation
with respect to wind, not community wind
specifically. Well, I'd love to mention, you know, wind does have the advantage that most of the profit is happening several dozen yards above the ground, and it leaves the ground available to have a second income stream, namely crops, which could also be bioenergy crops, or, you know, on marginal land, just sort of perennial crops like grasses and so on that could also be harvested. Of course, there's complexities in, you know, how much can you squeeze out of that because there's high transport costs and so on. But that would be one way to increase the land profitability by essentially doing multiple streams at the same time. But maybe I haven't quite answered that.
You know, benefits for wind development can occur at the local level, and in Montana with our large Judith Gap wind farm, we've really seen that in terms of annual payments to the landowner and in terms of very large payments to county governments that are going to schools and are going to infrastructure development. And that's, I think, probably on a state-by-state basis varies greatly, but it's the state legislators who need to be involved in setting that policy and who gets a benefit from it.
I think there are certainly benefits associated with landowners renting land for turbines to be built and constructed. And I think I mentioned earlier that a lot of these technologies have really complex value chains and they span several countries. There's actually a fairly recent study from the Peterson Institute, which basically says that with wind especially, regardless of where a company is based or a bulk of the manufacturing takes place, it's a kind of technology that will create local jobs if there is demand for it. And I think that's really the key caveat. I mean, for any of these benefits to accrue, there has to be demand for wind. I mean, turbines have to be getting built.
Well, thank you, everybody. I just heard the beautiful University of Montana.